Yeah, do take a seat, and if you've got a Bible there, do turn up Psalm 90 on your phone or in a Bible if you've got one. If you haven't, as always, obviously, I'll read it. Great excitement in our house this afternoon because it finally arrived, or in fact it arrived yesterday, but Hannah held it off strategically to fill a Sunday afternoon. Hannah's mum and dad turned 60 this year. They both have their birthday, 1954, they were born, obviously, if you've done the math. So they were 60 this year, so there's been lots of kind of family celebrations for them. We all went off for a big family holiday over the last half term in some massive great cottage, invaded the place, including Hannah's parents, mum and dad as well, so there was the four generations all gathered together, so that was marvellous. One of the things that Hannah and her sisters, she's got two sisters, have also done is to make a photo album where all of the cousins, so the godsons, of which there are six godsons, and the one grandsons, and one granddaughter, all the little kids are holding numbers from zero all the way to 60. And so over the last 6 months or so, every time we've been somewhere, or been doing something, or gone anywhere interesting or exciting, or whatever it might be, we've had to take these little foam numbers with us, and Hannah's had a little book with all the numbers, ticking them off slowly as we've gone, and the boys are there holding up a 6 or an 8 or a 59 or whatever it might be. And then, as you can do, you send it off, you arrange it on the internet, you create your own book with the pictures where you want it, you send it off, and you get this really nice hard-backed picture album. What I find amusing is Hannah and I and her sisters and partners, we don't get a look in this book. It's only the grandchildren. That seems to be what happened. I've worked out, basically, when we visit my parents now, or Hannah's parents, I'm just there to drive the car. I've figured that out now. Yeah. There's grandparents nodding at this. But this book arrived, and it's marvellous. And obviously Hannah and her sisters, one of them is Australia, so this is a global thing that's been put together, lives in Sydney. It arrived this afternoon. Hannah's got us our own copy as well of all these photos of all the cousins. And so this afternoon, the boys and I, while Hannah was having a bit of alone time and recovering from having four boys all week, the boys and I looked through this photo album of all these photos of their cousins. And it was great, and it was marvellous, and it was fantastic, and they really enjoyed it. Psalms, the book of Psalms in the Old Testament, is very much like a photo album in that sense, a kind of poetic or written photo album, in the sense that it's a collection of images into the life of the family that's called Israel, into the life of the nation which began as a family and then became a nation called Israel. And we know that because if you get familiar with the book of Psalms, for example, lots of the same people appear. So you see an image, a picture of David an awful lot. And David recounts an event. And in essence, it's a picture, a snapshot of that event. Or often it's a group called the Sons of Korah. We get an insight into what they're up to. They were like an ancient worship band, basically. And they wrote a whole bunch of worship songs. And there's like images of their concerts or their church services, and we can read about that image. There's pictures of different events, coronations of kings, the Psalms of Ascent, which are pictures of how all the people would arrive once a year in Jerusalem for a major festival. So there's photographs, poetic photographs of what that looked like and what that happened. Or there's kind of photographs of intense feelings. So there's things called laments, which are someone pouring out their heart in distress. It's like a photo. It would be inappropriate, wouldn't it, to actually take a photo at a funeral. You don't really do that, do you? But the Psalms do, and they capture people when they're lamenting or praising or full of prayer. So thinking of the Psalms as a photo album is quite a useful way of looking at it, and that it's loosely ordered. So often the photos of the same event are collected together. They might be a number of people's photos, like on Facebook after a wedding, you get tagged, don't you, in 5 or 6 different people's photographs. Sometimes you're the main character because it's your friend who's taking a picture of you. Sometimes you're blurry in the background doing some dad dancing because you weren't the main character, but different perspectives on the same event, loosely kind of collected together. So that's what Psalms is like. That's what the book of Psalms is a useful way to think of it. And tonight, we're doing this summer series in Psalms. Tonight, we're looking at my favourite psalm. I've heard Matt say that. I've heard Chris say that. Lawrence, I don't know if you've said it yet. But my favourite psalm is Psalm 90. In fact, it's the last paragraph. We'll get there. We'll work through from the beginning. But it's particularly the last paragraph of Psalm 90 that is one of my favourite places to go in the Bible and one of my favourite psalms. And we will get there, but we'll work through it from the beginning. It's also the only psalm written by Moses, which probably makes it the oldest of the psalms and potentially makes it the oldest piece of literature in the Bible. That this could well be the very first chronologically written down part of the Bible. There's older history that would have been oral history before it was written down. This probably predates that in a written form. So we're looking here at the only psalm written by Moses and probably the oldest written part of the Bible that we have. And what it does, its structure, if you like, is three couplets, three comparisons that contrast God with people. They put God in his rightful place and they put people in their rightful place. So let me scoot through them and show them to you. The first couplet is about God being eternal, but people being desperately frail. So sentence 1 and 2, which Matt's read a number of times now, very helpfully, is how eternal God is. Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. So he's a multi-generational God. He's existed through all generations. Before the mountains were born. So God is literally older than the hills. Or before you brought forth the whole world. So he's older than creation itself. And then it escalates to the crescendo. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. So before time began to after time finishes, you are God. So God is eternal. It's an escalating picture of God's eternal nature. But then verses 3 to 6, look how people compare to this. Verse 3, you turn people back to dust, saying, return to dust, you mortals. So by comparison, the image he says is actually people are like a tiny dust particle. As someone was closing the curtains just a few minutes ago, and maybe there was a little bit of dust gathered on the curtain, but I saw that, the glinting of the dust, as you do, don't you, when the sun's on it, and it floats down. He says you're like one of those minuscule little dust particles that the sun grapples with. Verse 4, 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has just gone by, or like a watch in the night. So, if we were fortunate to live to 100, that would be 10 of us living to 100 consecutively. Probably 15 or 20 generations, that probably works out as. To God, that is what? It is like a day that has just gone, or a watch in the night. So what must one lifespan be like to God? If potentially 10 or 15 lifespans is like a night, and I sleep well. I have man ears in our house, much to Hannah's annoyance. I wake up in the morning, did the boys sleep through? What a great night it was. And she's like, what are you talking about? You know, nights for me go like that, literally. I put my head on the pillow at 11, 11.30. The alarm goes off at 6. And I'm like, what's gone on? I've only just gone. And to God, that's what we're like compared to God. We're like just a moment, a forgotten moment, a night that slept through. Or the next sentence, you sweep people away in the sleep of death. The word sweep there is the language of a flood that just comes in and everything is just taken with it and it disappears. I grew up in Africa my boyhood in Africa, and I remember the torrential kind of monsoon rain that would come when the ground was rock hard like concrete, so the water couldn't penetrate it, and it would be thunder and lightning worse than we had just a few days ago. And when the floods came, they would sweep through. And the house that we lived in was designed so every other brick on the bottom row was missing, so the water could rush through, because if you didn't do that and it hit a solid brick wall, the house would go. The house would be knocked down by the pressure of the water. So you made sure nothing was left on the floor and our tables and chairs in the dining room. I remember it clearly, my dad bolting them down. So as the water swept through, they just cascaded round them, went through the house and out the other side. And me and my brother used to love it, making little paper boats and putting them on one side and watching them race through the house as the water came through. But if those little holes weren't there and the house had been built solidly, well, experience had taught the architects, it would have just gone, disappeared, wouldn't it? And what would have been left? A bit of rubble, a bit of detritus. And he says, that's what we are. That's how frail we are. And pastorally, the amount of times I've sat opposite someone who's been hit by illness, and they said, it's like I've been hit like a tsunami. It came from nowhere, and it smashed me off at my feet, and nothing's left of me. I feel empty. Or the last image here is of a withered stem, sentence 5 and sentence 6. They, that's people, are like the new grass of the morning. In the morning it springs up new, but by evening it's dry and withered. And remember Moses, he spent 40 years in the desert, didn't he? And I'm not experienced with deserts, but according to David Attenborough, they stand totally barren, don't they? And then the rain falls, and overnight this shoot comes up, doesn't it? And the plant grows, or the cactus flowers. And yet it lasts literally just hours before the sun has dried it up and it's withered and gone. So I guess that's what's in Moses' mind here, isn't he? He's saying a human life, even 70-odd, 80-odd years, the 70 and 10 that some of us hope we might get, actually is just like that desert stem. Comes quickly, disappears even more quickly, it's gone. So it's fairly, in a sense, bleak, that opening couplet, that opening comparison. God is eternal, and that's magnificent good news, as Matt was rightly pointing to. But in comparison, it's important that we see where we are, that we are frail, that actually it answers questions like whose is the safest pair of hands to put things in? Who is the greatest person to trust? Is it ourselves? Or actually is it God? When you see the comparison, God becomes the obvious answer to that, doesn't he? The second couplet, though, is actually a bit bleaker still. The psalm gets better. It's the last couplet, my favourite part, which is the good news, in a sense. The middle one gets bleaker still, 7 to 11. Is God angry and people sinful? God angry because people are rebellious or sinful. We can see that it's God who's angry. Let me read 7 to 11 and see if you can note the four times the idea of God's anger is mentioned. Sentence 7. We are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. We finish our years with a moan. Our days may come to 70 years or 80 if our strength endures. Yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly fly, they quickly pass, and we fly away. If only we knew the power of your anger. Your wrath is as great as the fear that is your due. So did you see the idea of God's anger there? Verse 7, your anger. Verse 7 again, terrified by your indignation. Indignation is another word linked to anger, doesn't it? Rightful anger. Or twice in verse 11, if only we knew the power of your anger. Your wrath is great. And so here we have this common biblical theme, though it's very uncomfortable for us, that God is angry in a just and a right way. It's not like, for example, I had a call this afternoon, an email rather, this afternoon from someone asking about my thoughts on whether they've got young children, a young child, whether that they should smack the child. Was that an appropriate mechanism of discipline? There's a whole discussion we can have at the end of the service over a cup of tea around that. But one of the things I did say was, if you are angry at that moment, definitely not strike in anger. Maybe never strike at all, but definitely don't strike in anger, because our anger is irrational and emotional and normally disproportionate, isn't it? I often am angry at the boys, not so much because they're being pickles, but because they're being pickles just at that point when my attention is elsewhere. So I'm very inconsistent. God's anger is not like that. God's anger is settled and righteous and just, and actually something we long for. When we see an injustice in the world or done to us and we say, that's not fair, what we are in essence saying is, God, I want you to be angry and I want you to deal with that that's happening. But here, the couplet is that God is angry, but the reason is that we, if you like, all of us, are sinful and rebellious and broken. Look at sentence 8. He says, you have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. And so Moses here, and remember, if you know Moses' history, you know that he tried to hide some fairly major sins. He murdered someone and ran to try and disguise that. But he says, actually, the one person you can't hoodwink is God. A couple of nights ago, I heard clamping and noises and banging upstairs after the boys were meant to be asleep, and I scooted up there to find out what was going on. And obviously their light was off, they were meant to be asleep. I opened the stair gate that's there. All three of our older three are all in the same room by their choice, so it's carnage and smells really bad. But I walked in, and I went to put the light on, and Isaac said, "Daddy, don't put the light on!" And I went, "Why, Isaac?" Because you know that they're trying to hide something they've done. They're trying to keep their sin hidden, aren't they? They don't want the light on, because when I switched it on, I found they were all naked. They do not take after their father, just to be clear in that. But we try and do that, don't we? We try and keep our sin hidden, and we're reasonably successful at it. And if you are middle class, then you've been very well trained in keeping your sins appropriate, acceptable, and hidden. But here, he says, God sees them all. And they make him angry. And he's really not happy about it. But it's not just our sin. It's also, if you like, the frailty we face in life, if you like. It's the fact that we are frail and that we die. Look at verse 9. All our days pass away under your wrath. This is a consequence now of anger, that actually our days come under God's anger. We finish our years with a moan. Now, how accurate is that? If you've ever had the privilege, but the painful privilege, of standing, sitting next to someone, holding their hand as they breathe their final breath, we die with a sigh and a moan. That's it. T.S. Eliot, this is how the world ends. Not with a bang, but with a whimper. And it's true, isn't it? And the reality of advances in medical science and technology means that more and more people die with a whimper and a sigh and a moan. It's drawn out and becomes more and more painful. God is eternal. We are so desperately frail. God is angry and we are sinful. There is a brokenness, a difficulty in the world. And the last example of this difficulty that we face in the world, the consequence, if you like, of sin, is found there in verse 10. Sorry, it's the struggle we face in life. Verse 10, our days may come to 70 years or 80 if our strength endures, which is the Bible's way of saying if you're lucky, you'll get 80, which is still roughly about right, I think, for 30-something-year-old in today's generation. As a bloke, I should make about 82 if I'm totally average. That's where I'll hit. So some of you are hoping for an extra innings or two, but that's how long we've got if our strength endures. Yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow. Life is difficult, isn't it? We live the consequences of our sin. We reap the consequences. Life has real sorrows and burdens in it. Let's pause and get our wits just around us for a moment. God is eternal and we are frail. God is angry and we are sinful and struggle and face death. Get our wits around it by looking at the question that comes in verse 11. Now, your translation may not have the first sentence in verse 11 as a question. Mine doesn't, and it's probably wrong. It should be a question. Mine says, if only we knew the power of your anger. The Hebrew is in a question form. And I think it should read something like, who can give an answer to your anger? Just the new there, who can know your anger, is the idea of know an answer, have a response to your anger. And then it's in a question format. So I think verse 11 is the question, who can give an answer to this reality? Who can give an answer to this tension of God's eternal nature and our frailty, of God's anger and our sinfulness? Where is the answer to this? And that question there is a classic example in the Psalms and all over the Old Testament, where the Old Testament asks a question and begins to point to an answer, but it's the New Testament that provides the answer. And so there's loads of unfinished, if you like, things, unfinished questions, unanswered queries in the Old Testament that were real challenges for Moses and his contemporaries at the time. Who can give an answer to your anger? And then Jesus comes, you see, and is the solution. So we could turn to, if we wanted, to somewhere like 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, 9 and 10, where Paul writes to the church in Thessalonica and says, "For you turned from idols to the living and true God, and to wait for his Son from heaven, who he raised from the dead, and who rescues us from the coming wrath." He's heard those last two clauses of Jesus, who he raised from the dead, which is the answer to the frailty and death, isn't it? And who rescues us from the coming wrath, which is the answer to God's anger. So where Moses was kind of left in the dark here, he just had this huge question hanging over his head, there is a reality that we can point to Jesus and say, actually, the answer to our frailty is Jesus, that he's raised from the dead and we can be as well. And Christians desperately need reminding of that all the time. It leaks out of me like oil out of an old car. It seeps out of me until I suddenly find I'm not really chugging along too well and I need to do something about it. Put it back in. He will rescue you from death because he's rescued himself from death, defeated death. It's a certainty. But also rescued from God's wrath, that rightful anger. Jesus says, "I will stand in your place and free you from it." And so it lands on the last couplet, which is my favourite one. And the final contrast between us and God, sentences 12 to 17, is how we are to respond. For us, how we're to respond to Jesus. But how we are to respond to God. And God here is shown as endlessly compassionate and people needing to be humble before God and contrite before God. There's four relationships he uses here to describe how we are to relate to Jesus, how we relate to God. The first is as a student relates to a teacher. Verse 12, "Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom." So the first response we should make to God is actually like a student, humble enough to say, "I need a teacher to make me wise. And I'm coming to God to make me wise." When it says, "Teach us to number our days," that doesn't mean we pray to God and say, "God, would you tell me, am I going to get my 82 years? Or am I going to get my 64 years? Or, you know, it's not a number like that. It means teach us to make our days count. Do you see the difference? To make today count. Teach us not to waste our lives, but actually to make every moment that we're given matter. Whether it is 62 years, 34 years, 12 years, or you break the century and get your letter from the Queen. Make it matter. Make it matter. The second image is of a servant to a master, sentence 13. "Relent, Lord. How long will it be? Have compassion on your servants." So you see God as a compassionate, merciful master. We're to be respond like servants, not just students to a teacher, but servants now to a master. There's a real humility in that, isn't there? A readiness to say, "Lord, I need you as my master to treat me with mercy. Not because I'm a deserving servant, but because you are a good master." The third image is of a dependent relating to a generous benefactor. Sentence 14 and 15. "Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble." And you can see Moses reflecting on 40 years in the wilderness and praying that God, the good benefactor, will reward that 40 years of wilderness life with greater than they had experienced in the negative. But it's God here as a great benefactor, a good benefactor. And we coming before him as a dependent and saying, you need to satisfy us. You need to make us glad. Without you, I cannot be satisfied. Without you, I cannot be glad. And I've said to people before, exploring the Christian faith, actually at the heart of becoming a Christian is a selfish motivation. Because by trusting in God, your satisfaction and joy in life will increase. So actually God's glory, God being shown as great and good, is the same as us knowing true joy. So we're both selfishly motivated and motivated by the glory of God in seeking to be satisfied by God, because the more we're satisfied in Jesus, the more he's glorified in us, isn't he? But the more satisfied we are than we ever could be. And then the last image is of an employee to a boss, 16 and 17. "May your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. May the favor of the Lord our God rest on us. Establish the work of our hands for us." Yes, establish the work of our hands. Can you see that that imagery of work there, the work of their hands. And remember, Moses and all of the Israelites were predominantly from an agricultural background. They worked the land with their hands, and they're saying, God, the creator, the one who sends the rain and fertilizes the soil, establish the work of our hands. It's like an employee responding to a boss. So the question to settle on, a couple of questions to mull over as we leave and go have our cup of cocoa before going to bed, or a glass of wine, or whatever it is you do on a Sunday night. How do you see God? Eternal, like that first couplet. Wrathful and angry, rightly, like that second couplet. But compassionate, ultimately compassionate in Jesus, like that third couplet. And how do you see yourself? Do you realize, do we realize our frailty, like that first couplet? Easier for some of us to realize, harder for others, depending on our stage of life. We still maybe feel immortal. But do we realize our frailty? Second couplet, do we realize our sinfulness, our brokenness? Do we realize why life is so difficult and hard and there are struggles? It's because there is sin in the world. But then thirdly, do we respond to God and what he's done and his compassion in Jesus with humility? Not arrogance, but like a student who comes before a teacher knowing that is the source of wisdom. Or like that servant who comes to their good master saying, I need your favour upon me, master, as your servant. Humility like the dependent who comes to the benefactor. I depend entirely upon you for my satisfaction. So I come before you because there's no other source, no other benefactor. Humble like an employee who comes to his boss and says, I've done this work, but only you can establish it. Establish the work of my hands. As a parent, as a partner, in my workplace, in church. I can do the work, but you have to establish, you have to make it last, if it's to last. Why don't I pray for us, and then Matt will close us with a song.